You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as Luis Moreno Ocampo bids farewell as the International Criminal Court prosecutor, we get the verdict on his 9 years' work. Also ahead, Barack Obama gives the Israeli President Shimon Peres the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Is the US-Israeli relationship really as good as it seems? And we also speak to our contributor Tristan McConnell, who's just got back from Somalia, where he's been to places journalists usually steer clear of.
The countries that are involved in the fight here have their own strategic security interests at heart. And that means they've got a kind of spine to them that perhaps foreign missions in the past have lacked.
And could this be au revoir Cannes, Terve, Lapland? Finland provides competition for the Côte d'Azur Film Festival. There may be more mosquitoes, they argue, but at least the sun shines at 3 a.m. Plus, we'll have a song or two. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. But first, let's catch up on the latest global headlines with Vaughan Savage.
Monocle 24 News at 1700 hours. France says the United Nations should have the power to enforce Kofi Annan's Syrian peace plan. Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius said adding a no-fly zone was an option under consideration to stem what was now a civil war. His comments were the toughest yet from a major power in response to the relentless violence in Syria, where many hundreds of civilians, rebels and government forces have been killed since a ceasefire was supposed to open up a chance for political talks to resolve the crisis. Fabius said he hoped Russia would agree to the United Nations invoking Chapter 7, which can authorize use of force. Meanwhile, Russia's foreign minister has defended his country's sale of arms to the Syrian government and accused the United States of supplying rebels with weapons. American Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says Russia may be sending attack helicopters to Syria, but Moscow argues its arms transfers are unrelated to the conflict there.
They have, from time to time, said that we shouldn't worry, everything they're shipping is unrelated to their actions internally. Patently untrue, and we are concerned about the latest information we have that there are attack helicopters on the way from Russia to Syria, which will escalate the conflict quite dramatically.
Earlier today, Turkey's foreign ministry said 2,000 people fleeing the violence in Syria have crossed the border in the last 48 hours. Britain's ruling coalition government has split along party lines after Liberal Democrats refused to support Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron in a vote over his handling of a minister accused of pulling strings for media tycoon Rupert Murdoch. The Lib Dems, junior partners in the coalition, abstained in the parliamentary vote on a motion calling on Cameron to order an inquiry into the actions of Jeremy Hunt, the Conservative Secretary of State for Culture and Media. The Hunt issue has given the Lib Dems an opportunity to mark their differences with the Conservatives, with whom they have had an uneasy relationship since forming the coalition in 2010. Two earthquakes have struck northern Afghanistan, killing up to 80 people. The victims are mainly women and children, buried when a landslide was triggered by the quakes. British activists against tax avoidance have won court backing to challenge a deal allowing Goldman Sachs to cut its tax bill by an estimated £10 million in Britain. The privately negotiated deal between the American Investment Bank and the UK Tax Authority was criticised by a British parliamentary panel, which said relations between the tax authorities and large companies were far too cosy. A Chinese-born Swedish investor with Japanese backing has agreed to buy the bankrupt car maker Saab Automobile and will revive it as a maker of electric cars, at first mainly for China. Saab, a maker of iconic cars since 1947, crashed into bankruptcy at the end of last year, less than 2 years after former owner General Motors sold it to Dutch group Spyker. Though an admired brand, it has struggled for years to survive against bigger competitors. Poland's interior minister has asked the courts to crack down harshly on those responsible for the violence which marred yesterday's Euro 2012 football match between Poland and Russia. 184 people, mostly Poles, were arrested. Manchester United, the world's best-supported soccer club, has ditched its plans for an Asian stock market flotation and is preparing to list in the United States, according to sources. The club first eyed a Hong Kong listing, then planned a $1 billion listing in Singapore in the second half of last year, before putting plans on hold because of market turmoil. And those are the main stories this hour here on Monocle 24.
Vaughan, thank you very much indeed. The time is 5 minutes past the top of the hour and you're listening to Midori House. Welcome back. It's 11 years since Kofi Annan declared the brand new International Criminal Court as a gift of hope to future generations and a giant step forward in the march towards universal human rights and the rule of law. Well, today the court's prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, bids farewell after 9 years of prosecuting some of the world's worst criminals. So what's the verdict on him and indeed the effectiveness of the court in general? Well, to assess the situation, I'm joined by the author, journalist and Monocle contributor, Adam Labor. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Adam. Luis Moreno Ocampo, described as charismatic but controversial. What would you say to that?
I think that's a very good summary. He is certainly very charismatic when you meet him. He's got a real charm and personal warmth about him. But at the same time, it's not entirely clear that in a position like that you want someone who's so charismatic, because his job was to essentially build up the institution slowly and gain credibility for it and gain respect. And the record's a bit erratic, really.
What do you mean the record is erratic? Because any reports you hear of him do say that, well, that there was increased criticism of him, of his work, the further he got into the job.
Well, the court's been in existence for something like 10 years, and it's only just now handed down its first conviction. So I think that's the first criticism. And obviously, it's not all up to him. I mean, he's the prosecutor, so he looks after the prosecution case, but he's not actually running the court in itself. But the court itself has been problematic since its birth. Although it's something that's to be welcomed and something needed, it's had a troubled past.
It may well have had a troubled past, but we'll move on to the court in a moment. But let's have a look at Ocampo and his and what he said when he came into an office was to say he promised swift justice to those who were unable to bring the wrongdoers to a court themselves. A lot of criticism that you read about him is that his methods were insufficiently thorough. For example, when he was investigating Bashir in Sudan, that they never got close enough to any of the important witnesses in order for a decent case to actually brought against them. And although he's trying to balance this because it has to be done quickly and expediency, only 50% of the cases that he considers are actually passing the burden of proof test in order to justify a warrant.
Yes, well, I mean, I think that's one of the big problems with this, with the court, is that it's something entirely new. So when he's going to Sudan to investigate potential charges against members of the Sudanese government, he needs the permission of the Sudanese government to be in Sudan and to operate and to investigate. Now, obviously, when he's there or his team is there, anyone working for the ICC is there, they're going to be tracked and followed. And the people that they want to talk to, you know, under a regime like that or any other nasty dictatorial regime, I'm certainly not going to want to talk to the ICC. So it's a very complicated thing that he's trying to do here. And that's, I think, one reason why it's proved so difficult to get the process going, especially in countries where they have a very strong and efficient government like Sudan. You know, to get the case going on Darfur has proved extremely problematic.
It is incredibly problematic, but is that possibly not the role of the prosecutor to ensure that the methods of investigation are indeed thorough? And of course, the ICC is allowed to... its remit extends to genocide, war crimes and crimes against humanity if the country itself in question doesn't actually want to cooperate. So they can really go in if they really want to.
Well, they can. It's true what you say, but they can do that with any country that's signed up to the Rome Statute and accepts the jurisdiction of the ICC, which Sudan has not. But Sudan was referred to the ICC by the Security Council, the United Nations Security Council, so that supersedes the Rome Statute. But again, they get bogged down in the politics. That you know, if they have sufficient political backing from the Security Council, then they're in a much more powerful position. But Russia and China, as you see in Syria, are not keen on any supranational institution meddling around in other people's business.
One of the criticisms that the African Union actually said that they don't in principle object to the ICC. In fact, they positively welcome the position of the ICC. But they didn't like Ocampo's style of justice. What do you think they meant by that?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose they didn't like his slightly swashbuckling approach. But as soon as you have any international organisation poking around in Africa and trying to impose justice on some of the hideous crimes that are going on there, some people will rear up and say that it's imperialist meddling. I mean, if you look at what happened with President Bashir of Sudan, I mean, a warrant was issued for him, but it got very little support within the African Union, and he still travels reasonably freely to some neighbouring countries. So again, the court gets bogged down in politics. I mean, I think it's very hard for a court like this to operate unless it has very, very strong political support at all levels of the UN Security Council, which it doesn't. So it's sort of going off at half speed, which is why you see all these contradictions and zigzags and delays. But that said, it has passed a sentence on a warlord for use of child soldiers. Now, it's very clear that in Africa, where other places are using child soldiers and continue to do so, this is going to be noticed that sooner or later, it might take 5 years or 10 years or 20, but there is a process now. There's an institution that you can't just do what you want and think that you're going to get away with it, because there are people that are going to come after you for this. And I think that's very important.
You mentioned the fact that Africa is obviously the focus of this, and there has been such a criticism that the fact that the list of the most wanted are fueled by the majority are African names. Do you think this is Ocampo himself, or do you think this is just symptomatic of the fact that the majority of the evildoers in this world just happen to be in Africa?
Well, I think an awful lot of evil things happen in Africa. I mean, there's been a war going on and off in Congo for years, and most estimates say that something like 5 million people have been killed in this war, which is an extraordinary amount of people. It gets almost no publicity. Nobody writes about it. Nobody particularly cares about it outside the UN and humanitarian organisations and the ICC. So there's an awful lot of bad people there. If you look at what's been going on in Sudan, in Darfur, that's clearly a genocide. There's been an attempt to eradicate certain ethnic groups in parts of Sudan. And again, now we see there's stories again that there might be child soldiers being used in the Ivory Coast. I mean, horrors are happening there. So I think that's kind of reflected in the preponderance of indictments.
Let's move on to the next prosecutor for the ICC, Fatou Bensouda, a woman from the Gambia. She has said that she's offended when she hears criticisms about the so-called African bias. What do you think Ms. Bensouda will have to do?
Well, I think first it's very good that they've got an African woman who's going to take over after a South American man. So I think she's going to have to perhaps go to Africa and speak to the leaders and explain that, this isn't some kind of imperialist setup to European justice to African leaders, that this is part of the international legal system now. And the African states are also part of that, and she has to do some serious advocacy to make it clear that they need to take part and they need to support this, because it's obviously in no one's interest, apart from the warlords and the murderers, that these kind of things keep happening, that these kind of atrocities and killings keep on.
So how does she ensure that she can strike that difficult balance of getting to the heart of the judicial requirements and gathering evidence and making sure that the cases are strong enough, but also at the same time ensuring cooperation from the countries and the organisations involved?
Well, I think that's a very you've got it in a couple of sentences there. That's an extreme. It's going to be extremely challenging. I think there's a difference between when you have a conflict that's carried out by warlords within a state, and the state is opposed to those warlords or is not party to that conflict. Then it's going to be easier to get the government on side to help bring the warlords to justice. The problem, the conundrum, which just goes round and round in circles, is when you have something like Sudan and Darfur, where the government itself is carrying out the genocide and the atrocities, or encouraging them, or facilitating them. Now, how she's going to land in Khartoum and explain to President Bashir that really he should surrender to the ICC and be arrested, I mean, obviously that's not going to happen. So I think there's going to have to be a certain amount of realism as well. But again, all these things, even though that it's not very likely that President of Sudan is going to be arrested and brought to the ICC for some time, it corrodes those regimes. We saw this in Yugoslavia, that once the indictments started being handed out to people like Mladic and Milosevic and Karadzic, it has a corrosive effect. People start to distance themselves. People start to think, oh, you know, am I going to be called to account one day for this? It makes them uneasy. It's like a slow drip drip. So we have to give it time.
Also, you mentioned throughout this interview the fact that the ICC is a relatively new court. It's 11 years old, and of course its case law is going to develop incrementally. And you say it runs slowly and it's inefficient. What would you recommend could be done?
Well, I think it should have much more resources. I mean, it doesn't have a lot behind it, really. It needs more prosecutors, more support, more money, more staff, more researchers, more investigators, more outreach teams, and it needs more political support. No, it needs the proper backing of all members of the Security Council, including Russia and China, and that would really give it, you know, a new momentum.
This is something that Fatou Bensouda actually said. She's launched a coded attack on the United States and China for not signing up to the ICC. Finally, do you think she'll ever achieve that?
I think it's unlikely for the moment. It's that either of those countries will sign up to the ICC. I mean, the United States did sign up to the ICC, but didn't ratify it. But because they say that their fear is that American soldiers, you know, could be called to account, or American politicians could be called to account for some political decision that they take. And this, whereas China's position is one of complete non-intervention in other countries' internal affairs. So I think China is probably a lost cause, but America might not be there if the ICC can be shown to act politically objectively and not be part of the kind of, you know, howling anti-American chorus that you hear sometimes.
Adam Labore, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was the journalist, writer and Monocle contributor Adam Labore. The time is 17 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be back in a moment where we assess the current status of US-Israel relations.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The Entrepreneurs is about finding the human face of successful businesses, meeting the men and women at the helm of enterprises with staying power, and handpicking the ideas that really matter amongst the hubbub. From international tech firms to setting up shop in your local community, we cover people-centred businesses, big and small, and gather a few pointers on how to strike out on your own along the way from the people who really know about self-started success.
Get big or die trying.
The latest edition of The Entrepreneurs looks at a man shining a light on Egypt's renewable energy industry. We'll also be looking at how sustainability can now underpin solid business strategy rather than being a boring chore standing in the way of growth. And we'll be talking South American opportunities with the man who's reshaped the Argentinian hospitality and food scene.
You have a way of looking at design and style that draws you in. You don't want to leave, you want to stay there because you're having a good time.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House. The White House has described Shimon Peres as the man who's strengthened the unbreakable bond between Israel and the United States. In recognition of this, the Israeli president will be awarded the Medal of Freedom. So are relations as cozy as ever, in particular when it comes to issues as thorny as Syria and, of course, Iran. Well, to discuss this, I'm joined by Fawaz Jerjes, who's Professor of Middle Eastern Politics and International Relations at the London School of Economics. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Fawaz. The line there from the White House describing Shimon Peres as basically the fixer who married Israel to the West. What would you say to that?
Well, I mean, I think what we need to understand is that Shimon Peres is a liberal-minded statesman. He and Barack Obama are on the same page. Barack Obama would have loved to have Shimon Peres as the Prime Minister of Israel. He is the opposite kind of a statesman from Benjamin Netanyahu, who governs Israel. And what Barack Obama has been trying to do in the last year or so is to mend the rift that basically emerged between the Obama administration and the Netanyahu administration. And there is no better person than Shimon Peres to highlight the historic nature and the special relationship between the United States and Israel.
So what's been the reaction in Israel to the award of the Medal of Freedom?
Well, you know, unfortunately for Barack Obama has never resonated among the Israeli public. From day one, many Israelis basically did not like Barack Obama. First of all, because of who he is. Secondly, because of his outreach to Muslims. Thirdly, because of his really a drive, his quest to achieve to broker a Palestinian-Israeli state. And his speech in Cairo, after a few months after his inauguration, turned many Israelis against him, in particular the right wing in Israel. And Netanyahu is really more Republican than many American Republicans. He has done his best to basically mobilize a critical segment of the right in the United States, and in particular among the Jewish community, against Barack Obama, even though Barack Obama is one of the most pro-Israeli presidents in America's history. He has given Israel a carte blanche from, foreign aid to arms to technology, and also his policies on Iran basically are very much in harmony with the Israeli public as well.
So Obama and Peres obviously attempting to strike a sort of conciliatory balance. But Leon Panetta has suggested that the Israeli policies are partly responsible for increasing diplomatic isolation in the Middle East. That's obviously going to make things worse.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the reality is, the Americans, when Barack Obama came to power, when he inherited what they called a bitter legacy that really stemmed from the 9/11 wars, in particular George W. Bush policies, the invasion of Iraq, the torture, Guantanamo Bay. What Barack Obama really has tried to do is to basically facilitate, broker a Palestinian-Israeli conflict. The reality is, forget about Iran, forget about anything else, the Palestine-Israel conflict is the most fundamental fault line, basically, in relation between the United States and the greater Middle East, and also between Arabs and Muslims on the one hand and Jews on the other. And what Barack Obama really has tried to do is to find a way to facilitate a settlement. Basically, Netanyahu was not interested in a Palestinian state. Benjamin Netanyahu did not want Barack Obama to focus on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. He wanted Barack Obama to focus on the so-called threat of Iran. And that's why three major confrontations between Barack Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu, and guess what? Benjamin Netanyahu won the three confrontations. Barack Obama surrendered on the three confrontations. After all, Barack Obama is a politician. He wants to be reelected. And that's why now I think you can't understand what Barack Obama is trying to do, except within the context he is fighting the battle of his political career, reelection, and the Jewish vote in the United States. All the polls show that he's basically down by almost 15 points. In the first presidency, he won almost 75%. Of the Jewish vote. Now, the polls, opinion polls, show that he is 60-65. And what he's trying to do is to really basically appeal and reach out to the Jewish community by saying, look, I support Israel, even though I disagree with Benjamin Netanyahu and his right-wing policies on the Palestinian question.
There's also arguably reports of increased hostility against Israel, especially in academic circles in the United States.
Well, you know, really, I mean, when Barack Obama came to office, I mean, remember, Barack Obama, really most of his foreign policy team come from the Clinton administration. This is one of the Clinton administration, Hillary Clinton is the Secretary of State, Robert Gates was the Defense Secretary. They're all pro-Israeli, that's not the question. But I think a consensus has emerged among the American foreign policy community is that Israel is its own worst enemy. That Israel must be basically helped against, because after all, Israel now is a very besieged island in a sea, of a changing, volatile sea, in particular in the aftermath of the Arab uprising, the Arab Spring uprising. Even Western public opinion in Europe here, I mean, just talking, I mean, the world public opinion is extremely anxious about Israel's policies in particular. I mean, it colonizes Palestinian lands. It basically, I mean, this is, I mean, in particular, does not really appreciate how world public opinion basically views the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. In the United States, more and more Americans are really rethinking the special relationship with Israel, in particular in light of the, I mean, really core policies of Benjamin Netanyahu, not just in the universities. I mean, even public polls in the United States show that more and more Americans are basically anxious about the policies that Benjamin Netanyahu has been pursuing, policies that not only undermine Israel's security, long-term security, but also does a great deal of damage to America's reputation in the Arab and Muslim world. Remember, the United States is the only major supporter of Israel. The United States provides Israel with more than $3.1 billion in annual aid. The United States basically, provides the political and military and moral support for Israel. And that's why Israel's policies reflect on America's image and standing in the Arab world. And that's why even the American military, General Petraeus, one of the top, now he's the chairman, he is the chief of the CIA, he said that Israel's policies have a direct impact on American security, American national security, American soldiers, the life of American soldiers. This tells you how the Palestine-Israel conflict affects relations between the United States and the greater Middle East.
So you mentioned that with, and in addition to that, I think Barack Obama has pledged that the United States will always, I quote, have Israel's back when it comes to Israel's security. The key area that this leads me to focus on is obviously Iran. Shimon Peres has said that time's running out. To what degree do you think the United States will always have Israel's back, especially when it comes to the issue of Iran?
Well, I mean, the Americans, I want you to know that the American national security team, whether it's the military, the White House, the Defense Department, are extremely anxious that Benjamin Netanyahu would preempt their hand by carrying out military strikes against Israel. That's why Leon Panetta went public and says that we caution our Israeli friends not to go to war against Iran, because if war comes to Iran, this will become a region-wide war, a global war. But the reality is also Barack Obama forced himself into a bind, because of the pressure exerted by Israel and also by Israel's friends in the United States. Now he is on record saying that if and when Iran decides to build a nuclear bomb, the United States would basically go to war against Iran. This is a major gamble. This is the first time that Barack Obama said, if Iran, because Iran has not made a decision to build a nuclear bomb, this is the consensus in America, but if it does, Barack Obama now is on record saying, I will go to war. And the reason why he made that statement, in direct response to the pressure exerted on the Obama administration by Israel and its friends in the United States. And this tells you the extent to which pressure by Israel really has a major impact on American foreign policy in the Middle East, including Iran.
Thank you very much, as ever, for joining us here on Midori House. The news will be coming to us in just a few moments' time. Taking us there, let's have some music. This is Efrat Benzur. That was the Israeli singer Efrat Ben-Zur and Storm, taken from her latest album called Robin, where she sets verses by the American poet Emily Dickinson to her music. Stay with us here on Midori House, because we begin talking to our contributor Tristan McConnell, who's just come back from southern Somalia. We'll also argue why you should or shouldn't skip the Cannes Film Festival this year and head instead to Lapland. And we'll check in with Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound, who's been at Art Basel. But with the time at 29 minutes to the top of the hour, let's get the latest world news headlines from Vaughan Savage.
France says the United Nations should have the power to enforce Kofi Annan's Syrian peace plan. Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius said adding a no-fly zone was an option under consideration to stem what was now a civil war. Britain's ruling coalition government has split along party lines after Liberal Democrats refused to support Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron in a vote over his handling of a minister accused of pulling strings for media tycoon Rupert Murdoch. Two earthquakes have struck northern Afghanistan, killing up to 80 people. The victims are mainly women and children. British activists against tax avoidance have won court backing to challenge a deal allowing Goldman Sachs to cut its British tax bill by an estimated £10 million. And a Chinese-born Swedish investor with Japanese backing has agreed to buy the bankrupt carmaker Saab Automobile and will revive it as a maker of electric cars, at first mainly for China. And those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and it's time now to check in with one of our editors to find out what's tickling his or her fancy this week. Today we head to Basel to speak to our culture editor, Mr. Robert Bound, who's at the art fair there. Hello, Robert. How's it going in Basel?
Hi, Emma. It's going very well. I've worn out a lot of shoe leather walking around all the booths today. I don't know if it's shoe leather, but certainly my Converse have a narrower tread than they used to.
And what's been catching your fancy? Because Art Basel is huge, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty monstrous. It takes up both of the huge sort of aircraft hangars at the Messeplatz in Basel, one's the fair itself, which is obviously the selling thing, which is the booths, which is the galleries, great and small, most of them great, that exhibit here, and then the other Messeplatz is given over to Art Unlimited, which is the sort of curatorial thing, which is full of huge artworks, which are sort of for sale, but they're only if you've got a kind of private kind of humongous collection or a personal museum. Have you got a personal museum?
Several, thank you. If you could do a bit of hoovering up for me, please. I have a few small corners that need sort of tickling up slightly. I mean, the impression that we've had this year is that there's a deepening Eurozone crisis, so people will be reticent to dip their hands into their pockets. Is that true from what you've seen?
It seems, I think people have had, I mean, whoever you speak to, they always sort of say they've had quite strong sales. And then they say off the record, they sort of say something else. What I have heard this morning, which is crazy, a New York gallery were telling me that all their things have been bought by Spaniards and Greeks, genuinely. So it seems that there's something fishy going on with the levels of the crisis, or at least what the higher echelons of the people in those countries have been kind of investing their money in. Clearly, maybe they haven't been paying taxes, but they've been buying lots of art and keeping it in Swiss vaults. So that's sort of interesting. But I think that this year people are kind of in agreement that there are less Americans, which are obviously a huge buying force. But then maybe the slightly more sly and subtle Swiss come out and have taken their place this year. So I think people are saying strong sales still. It's obviously got such a cemented place in the art market calendar that people, the galleries do hold a lot of their best work back for this week or for the sort of two magical days on which the sort of big money collectors come into town and flash their checkbooks.
So there's clearly some beautiful art hanging on those walls. What have you spotted that surprised everybody that everybody might be going for?
Well, right at the sort of top end, there's a 70-odd million quid Rothko, which sort of has been sort of exciting people. I think it remains unsold as yet. But there's a lot of smaller stuff. There's a lot of by Basel standards cheaper things hanging up as well. A lot of works on paper, which normally tends to sort of dictate that there's a kind of problem with supply. You know what I mean? There's not enough kind of eminent oils on canvas, then you can get a Cy Twombly, but it'll be a work on paper, or a Bacon or a Freud, it'll be a work on paper. And again, there's quite a lot of modern as opposed to contemporary stuff. So, you know, the kind of blue chip names of dead artists, albeit 20th century artists, it looks like they're making the sort of headlines for the amount of money that they're making.
We've had a year where blue chip sales have been smashing records at auction. Do you think that the estimates or the price tags attached to this art at the moment is about right, or are hungry bidders who are possibly the Spanish and the Greeks who have a bit of spare cash are actually pushing things up higher than their natural estimate?
Yeah, I think they kind of are. I mean, I think that's sort of been happening. That's been happening at the auction houses, which have been still kind of unbelievable, actually, when you think of when you read the headline on your newspaper every morning, and then you kind of read, you know, page five, and you realise that, you know, another masterpiece has gone for more money than anything that anyone's ever seen before. Those things don't tally. So it seems, and a couple of people have said this at the fair today, that the upper echelons are sort of hoovering everything up and putting up prices right up, but the sort of middle market is sort of really, really disappearing, which is sort of dangerous because, you know, if anything happens to those big spenders, then the art market is an unnatural bubble, if you know what I mean, rather than it being a sort of bottom-up thing. It's very much a kind of top-down thing. It seems extra kind of crazy in the art world always.
So what are the people like in there at the moment? I read somewhere that some of the attendees this year are slightly more flamboyant than the works themselves.
Yeah, there's always a joy coming to any art fair and Basel. But there's a lot of... You could very easily call it Eurotrash with the volume turned up to 11. Emma, there's a lot of amazing sort of, like, there's a lot of like blokes in sort of even in odd shoes, you know. So we're talking orange trousers, bright green jackets, odd shoes, a lot of sort of all in one sort of body stockings, a lot of dark glasses worn inside. I suppose that makes it look like you're getting a discount when you're paying an eye-watering sum. There's a lot of good clobber on some natural and very obviously over manicured or plastic surgery enhanced bodies. You know what these places are like.
I can't wait to see what you might be picking up in terms of style tips when you come back to walk the editorial floor catwalk in a couple of days, Robert.
Put it this way, there'll be some extra sort of ventilation and some exceptionally neon colour schemes.
I do hope you won't be surgically enhanced, at least. Because there's no need.
I'll try not to get anything lifted.
Listen, we'll have to leave it in a minute. But do you think Basel's still the king of art fairs? Because there's so many more that offer competition nowadays.
Yeah, it is, actually. It's funny because, walking around the gallery, seeing some people I know sort of fairly well, they've sort of had 6 or 7 weeks on the trot of going from the new Free Fair in New York to Hong Kong to Paris and now here to Basel. And a lot of them are very worn out, but they, as I said before, they still, I think there's a temptation to leave to keep their best work for this art fair. That still seems to be the sort of magnet. And you know, having said that, there's fewer Americans this year. I've seen some of the sort of big name American collectors wandering around today as well. So I kind of think it's, you know, everyone wants to be nice to Basel because it is a bit like a sort of Death Star of an art fair that everyone's slightly scared of as well. So everyone's kind of keeping the end up for Art Basel, and I still think it's kind of top of the pile.
Robert, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in a moment with the latest from southern Somalia.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Normally, when reporters head to Somalia, they head to Mogadishu or safer regions in the north. But our contributor Tristan McConnell has just gone back from central Somalia. He went to Bakool in the southern region, which is renowned for being a lot more dangerous than the north. Earlier today, he spoke to Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield, and he began by telling him about his experience.
We went to, as you say, Bakool region. We went to the capital of Bakool, a town called Hodur. Kind of a farming area traditionally, and that's partly why July last year it was one of the first bits of Somalia that got named as a famine zone. It only became accessible to people like me, you know, foreign journalists, a couple of months ago when Al-Shabaab, the Al-Qaeda-linked Islamist militants who control large bits of mostly rural Somalia nowadays, were kicked out by a coalition of Ethiopian and Somali troops. So the new administration, or the government aligned administration, came in about a month ago, and I was going there with a doctor from the World Health Organization who was planning to establish the first free medical clinic that the region's had for years, really. And it was quite a scene. I mean, he brought in a whole load of medical equipment, essentially an operating theatre and a bunch of drugs. And on the first morning, word got around very quickly. There were well over 100 patients seen on the first day, about 150 or so on the second day. And it's all very routine stuff that they were doing, you know, sort of removing, abscesses and cysts and whatnot. It was all fairly bloody, but effective medicine. This kind of thing, this has not been possible under Al-Shabaab-controlled areas, because they basically threw all the aid agencies out, which meant that, you know, the most simple things that we tend to take for granted, you know, medical care, someone to help you deliver a baby, just haven't been available, and now they're beginning to be.
And the forces that threw out Al-Shabaab were mainly Ethiopian, weren't they? I mean, is there an Ethiopian Somalis had a very testy relationship for generations? How do the local population feel about the Ethiopian presence there?
Yeah, my experience in Fudur and in Baidoa, which is another town that the Ethiopians kicked Shabaab out of a couple of months ago, that I went to visit soon after it was liberated, as the Ethiopians like to say, is that the Ethiopians are pretty welcome. I think what happened is that over the last 3 to 4 years, the way that Al-Shabaab has treated the local population, the kind of brutal punishments that have been meted out, the ways that they've restricted everyday life, you know, dictating rather what you can wear, you know, whether you can listen to music, you know, what you learn at school, and just sort of summary beatings and, you know, executions, just really horrible stuff, has completely alienated the local populations. And there's very little support for Al-Shabaab to be found outside of their own ranks. And basically, it seems that the civilians in these areas have welcomed anyone who can boot them out. So the Ethiopians, despite what you alluded to, this sort of long and troubled history between the two countries, have been largely welcomed, as far as I can make out, in the places that I visited. And, one of the Somali intelligence officers I was chatting to, he was saying that they first tried to take Hodur, about 6 or 8 weeks ago, and they tried with a couple of hundred Somali government soldiers and failed miserably, got beaten back very quickly. And then they turned up with 2,000 Ethiopians, and this time round it was the Shabaab
who ran
for it. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear, and no one's really trying to hide the fact that the government soldiers themselves are incapable of defeating Al-Shabaab. But when you've got Ethiopians with tanks and very large, noisy machine guns, that tends to get the Shabaab scarpering.
When you look at the progress that the Ethiopians have made in Bakool, in the western central parts of Somalia, the progress that's been made in Mogadishu, the capital, with African Union forces, certainly making that city a bit safer. And then also you've got Kenyan troops in the south, near the border with Kenya. Do you get the overall impression, you know, having been to all three of those regions in recent months, that a corner has turned in the fight against Al-Shabaab within Somalia?
I think it has. I definitely think it has. The big change that seems to be coming, that we're seeing emerge, if you like, is through this concerted regional African effort. And I think it's very important, you know, that these are the countries that are involved in the fight here, Kenya and Ethiopia in particular, have their own, strategic security interests at heart. You know, they're not doing it for altruistic reasons. They want to protect their own countries. And that means they've got a kind of spine to them that perhaps foreign missions in the past have lacked. And they've shown a willingness to, certainly the African Union mission has shown a willingness to take casualties that other missions in the past have not. And that's been very important. But what the real change, I don't think Al-Shabaab is defeated. I don't think they've beaten them. We haven't seen the end of them. But what has changed is that they've lost control of towns, which means, something that was unique about Al-Shabaab as a sort of Al-Qaeda-inspired and latterly Al-Qaeda-aligned organization is they actually controlled territory. They controlled cities. They ran administrations. They took taxes. They provided, to an extent, services. And that was really unusual for an extremist group allied to Al-Qaeda. And now they're kind of reverting to a more traditional, if you like, scenario where they are being pushed out of the cities and towns. They're stuck in rural areas, and they occasionally pitch up to, do a suicide bombing or plant an IED or launch a kind of hit-and-run assassination. But the days of Al-Shabaab holding ground against military forces and controlling territory in an administrative capacity, I think, are very much numbered. They pretty much have two large towns left. That's a town called Merka and a town called Kismayo, both of which are on the coast south of Mogadishu. But, if you believe the chat that's coming from the Kenyan government, they're going to have a go at Kismayo soon, and perhaps Al-Shabaab will even lose that.
That was Tristan McConnell there speaking to our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield earlier on today about his travels in southern Somalia. You're listening to Midori House, and this is Amal Nook. She's dubbed Somalia's answer to Beyoncé with her song With You. And that was the singer Amal Nook singing With You. It's 10 minutes before the top of the hour, and you're listening to Midori House. Well, should the blazing stars of Hollywood bid farewell to the Croisette at Cannes and trade it in for a bucket load of mosquitoes and a night with no darkness? Well, that's what the organisers of the Midnight Sun Film Festival in Sodankola, Finnish Lapland, believe. The festival is held a chilly 120 kilometres above the Arctic Circle. And on the phone now, I'm joined by Timo Malmi, who's a programme director of the Midnight Sun Film Festival. A very warm welcome, Timo, to Midori House. Tell us about how this festival came about. What are the origins?
It was about 27 years ago when some Finnish filmmakers thought that there should be a different film festival than, let's say, Cannes Film Festival, and let's make it somewhere in the area where it will be an adventure to go there and have a different, really different kind of event where there is no competition of films or marketing, etc., this kind of glamour. But to concentrate on film art and filmmakers and the contacts with the audience.
Do you think that the Midnight Sun Film Festival is helped by the fact that there's no lack of glamour? Tell us about what the atmosphere is like.
Atmosphere is very intimate. You can meet, for example, we had 10 years ago Francis Ford Coppola here, and a normal average person from the street can meet Coppola and talk about Godfather or Upper Club Now with him, and like friend to another friend. So it's totally different than in places like Cannes Film Festival, where you can see the filmmakers only when they are walking on red carpet to the Festival Palais.
You mentioned the fact that you had Francis Ford Coppola there. Your film festival does attract the absolute A-listers, doesn't it?
Yes, that's true. That there is nobody who has said that, no, I don't come there. It's just a question of the schedule, if they are able to come in the middle of June. So we have had lots of very famous directors, but also the filmmakers who are not so well known, but are those people that should be discovered or rediscovered.
I mean, you've had the likes of Ford Coppola, Kieslowski, Miloš Forman have all been there. Does the festival therefore have an international feeling to it, or do you ensure that Finnish filmmakers get their work shown too?
This is for both international and Finnish filmmakers, and for international and Finnish audience. And most of the films are subtitled in English, and mostly we are speaking English, but there's lots of Finnish too.
Let's talk about how your town changes, how Sodankylä actually develops. You've got 10,000 people living there at any one time, and then that population more than doubles during the festival, doesn't it? How do you fit everybody in?
Well, that's a small problem, because there are, of course, not so much hotels, etc. We have to use hotels that are half an hour drive from here, but some of the people that come here are using local houses and schools, etc. And somehow we'll manage.
You manage. Also, I think when the festival was put together, I think the Karismäki brothers, who founded the festival, if I'm right in saying, didn't they try and make it really hard to get to? I mean, the transport, by all accounts, is quite difficult.
Well, yes, you must fly into Finland to our capital, Helsinki, and then take another flight from there to get into Lapland, and then take a bus or a car for 2 hours still. So it's quite a distance, but it's an adventure and worth of it.
Have you ever had a star say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to take the plane and the car and then the bus? Do you have people refusing to come?
Well, sometimes they are a bit, let's say, they don't know if it's that possible or so, but most of them can make it.
One thing that I'm being asked to ask you, I think it's from our producer Markus Hippi, who is all too aware of this problem. Apparently, you have quite a lot of mosquitoes where you are. How does that affect the atmosphere?
Well, the time is not yet so good for mosquitoes. They come usually a bit later. Summer has just started here, and if it's not too hot, like it's usually not, The mosquitoes are not traveling so much if you don't go by the riverside or near the water. So we'll manage somehow. Also, we who come from south. So the timing is very important. If this should be 1 or 2 weeks later, there are too much mosquitoes for most of us.
Which obviously would not be very pleasant at all. You say it's not too hot in Sudankula, but by all accounts, unfortunately, I think I was making a comparison with the Cannes Film Festival, where the stars often go on the red carpet dressed in not a great deal. I mean, isn't it a little bit too cold to dress up and be glamorous?
Yes, it is. It is. You should have warm clothes here. But otherwise, it's not too cold usually. For example, now we have 15 or 20 degrees and sunshine for the next days forecasted. And now it's a bit cold. But anyway, the climate is quite nice.
Timo Malby, thank you very much indeed. And just remind us when the Sun Film Midnight Sun Festival is on, please.
It started today and we will have it for 5 days until Sunday.
We wish you the very best of luck with that. Well, that's all we have time for today. The producer was Marcus Hippie. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Up next after the news is this week's episode of The Entrepreneurs, hosted by Jonathan Openshaw. He'll be talking to Juan Santa Cruz, one of Latin America's top hotel designers.
And there's the typical local restaurants that do not really appeal to the tourists, and they're doing pretty well. And then there are the restaurants like mine, which appeal to both the locals and the tourists, and those are extremely profitable.
And don't forget, in 3 hours' time, that's at 2200 hours, here in London, Chloe Potter and Andrew Muller will bring you today's Monocle Daily. They'll be talking about low-cost airlines and the aviation market in Africa. So stay with us for that. From us on Midori House, goodbye.